Welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost, the team from This Is Money, the award-winning money section of the Mail Online. Join me in the studio for our weekly catch-up. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Tanya Jeffries here today to talk through the top stories they've been investigating, including politicians are under attack for using pension tax relief like an election piggy bank. Can pension firms and insurers cope under the weight of calls about the new freedoms? And how divorce can seriously shrink your retirement fund? Also coming up, experts are warning we could be facing a very real housing crisis, as a fall in the number of properties coming onto the market will keep prices rising for years to come. New car tax rules you need to know to avoid hefty fines or a trip to the pound. And staying on that theme, Bentleys and Porsches, well, they may be posh, but according to a new survey, they're prone to break down more than other cars. What came out as the most reliable, we'll let you know. Plus, millions of us were glued to our TVs, our smartphones, laptops in pubs. We held parties for one main visual event. I'm not talking about the Challenger's election debate. A lot of people about my age getting goosebumps right now. That's the new Star Wars film trailer, of course, revealed at a fans' convention in California. It's already added almost £1.3 billion to the value of Disney since it was released. So in celebration, we're asking, please, for your favourite Star Wars character. Simon, Tanya, a very warm welcome, please. Simon, start us off, your favourite Star Wars character.
Good morning. Han Solo. He was definitely the best Star Wars character.
Classic choice, a classic
choice. He was cool. He was basically just cool. So the answer is Han Solo.
Tanya, yourself?
Hello. Well, I watched them for the first time when I was an adult, so I always prefer villains, and I really liked Darth Vader. He was seriously scary. A great character. Yes. That was good.
Thank you. Annie?
For me, I'm with Simon, Han Solo, all the way. And some of the responses so far. Emma says that she loves Yoda. I can't believe anyone's not mentioned Yoda yet. She says a lovely green little fella. Tina's gone for Princess Leia and her Cumberland sausage hairstyle. Paul says Chewbacca is my favourite because he didn't get involved in all of the politics. Other favourites include the jazz band in the bar, Luke Skywalker's aunt, curious one, Luke Skywalker himself, the Ewoks, and Greg says love a stormtrooper as well. Keep them coming in. Text us 66777. Start your text with the word share. Email us at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk, or you can tweet us at shareradiouk.
Who's the more foolish, Annie? The fool or the fool who follows him? Of course, it's Obi-Wan Kenobi for me.
Good one.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. If you've just joined us, I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1 on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. In the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Tanya Jeffries from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Coming up, we'll be talking about how politicians are under attack for using pension tax relief like an election piggy bank, and how divorce could slash your pensions income by £2,000 a year. But first, in the last figures released before the general election, it's been revealed that unemployment has fallen again, dropping by 76,000 between December and February to 1.84 million. The number of people claiming job seekers allowance last month also fell by just over 20,000. Average earnings in the year to February increased by 1.7%. So while not exactly stellar, still running ahead of inflation, and it comes as a new report from Glassdoor suggests improved confidence about jobs, with more than one in three workers optimistic about finding new employment within 6 months. So Simon, already good news, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty good news. There's no reason to say it's not good news, to be perfectly honest. A situation where people's wages are rising faster than the cost of living, so that's good news. Inflation's at 0% and wages going up at 1.7%. And unemployment continuing to fall is good news. I mean, it's a boost for the economy. The questions that are now starting to be raised about unemployment are, have we got the right kind of employment? There's been this big discussion about 0 hours contracts, whether Britain's flexible labour market is doing its employees any favours. But falling unemployment, wages going up, but not by too much. Good news.
And good news for the coalition, Tanya, I imagine. George Osborne must be rubbing his hands with glee, surely.
Yes, it is a long-term trend, but they'll be relieved that there was no upset just before the election when people were paying more attention.
Well, let's turn our attention, taking a look at pensions, an issue that's been keeping, well, Simon, your team, unsurprisingly, very busy. And not just your team, but advisers, insurers, PensionWise Guidance Service, it would seem, and politicians coming under attack. Now, why? Well, apparently they're using pension tax relief, like, I quote, an election piggy bank to fund other policies, such as slashing inheritance tax, a Conservative policy, and student tuition fees. That's from Labour. The SNP and the Lib Dems have both talked about creating a flat rate of pension tax relief, a boost to the current relief for basic rate taxpayers, but a cut for those earning more. But they've not linked this to any funding of any specific policy pledges. The most generous pledge of all, though, well, that comes from the Green Party. They say they'll replace the entire state pension system with a citizens' pension that will pay £180 a week regardless of contributions if it came into power. Simon, Tanya.
Well, I think the first thing to say is pension tax relief. You pay money into your pension. If you're a basic rate taxpayer, you get the 20% tax that you've paid back. If you're a 40% taxpayer, the 40%, 45%, 45%. And to most people, the principle behind this is that basically you don't pay tax on your pension contributions. So your pension contributions come out of untaxed income. And then when you draw your pension, you'll then be taxed on the income you get from it. And this does people a favour because most people will pay a higher rate of tax while they're working than they will when they're a pensioner. And whilst to the average person, the idea behind this would be there's the principle that you don't pay tax on your pension contributions, the Treasury doesn't really see it like that. They see it like they're doing you a favour by allowing you to have this tax relief. The political parties have decided to start hacking into it. Whether that's a good idea or not is something that's not quite certain, because realistically, yes, pension tax relief benefits higher earners more. They get a larger amount, but that's because higher earners earn more money and pay more tax. So if you're going to use that principle of not taxing pension contributions, obviously they're going to get more money. So then you've got them using various bits and bobs and saying, oh, we'll take this, we'll take that to fund these pledges. The inheritance tax thing, raising it to £1 million, but incorporating this sort of twist of your family home being in the extra bit on the combined allowance now, which is £650. The Labour Party talking about cutting tuition fees and hacking into higher rate taxpayers' relief for that. I just think, and the main criticism here is that they should stop meddling with this stuff because it's meant to be an incentive to save and stop messing around with it.
Well, Tanya, you wrote about this. Tom McPhail, who's the head of pensions research at Hargreaves Lansdown, said incessant tinkering and tax raids on retirement savings to pay for this week's pet policy simply undermine people's willingness and, some cases, their ability to provide for their retirement. Is that the danger then?
Yes, I think it's worth making the point, though, that they're tinkering for the higher earners. So most people won't necessarily be affected. But that said, Labour and Tories in particular are using this pot of money, as they see it, to fund other policies. With the other parties, they're at least thinking about changing pension tax relief within the pensions area, within the arena. But with with the Tories, it's inheritance tax. With Labour, it's tuition fees. They just want to have their favoured policies and find money for it. And there's immense pressure on them to fund these promises because they're in the middle of an election campaign.
Also, there's talk of the lifetime allowance coming down to 1 million from 1.25 million, a Labour proposal there. Your thoughts?
Well, I've spoken about this before. I think that is an absolutely terrible idea. People think about the lifetime allowance and they think, £1 million pension pot, that's a huge amount of money, I'm never going to have £1 million. But the people this hits is not the older, wealthier, baby boomer generation with final salary pensions, expensive houses that they've made a lot of money from property prices on over the years. The people this hits is younger workers who, with contributions to their pension and the effect of compounding of investment growth, might hit that £1 million pension pot. And £1 million only buys you a pension of, I think, £26,000, something like that. Many people will be hoping for a pension that's larger than that. And it's important to remember that that £26,000 in 30 years' time is not going to be worth £26,000. So the lifetime allowance should really be going up to recognise the fact that it's going to get more expensive to buy that income. And in fact, it's going down in the opposite direction. In fact, if it went to if it goes to 1 million, it will have gone from 1.8 million to 1 million in 5 years. And people should be really concerned about that, but they're not, because they don't realise that such a huge sum of money is actually something that could potentially affect them.
So if people are looking elsewhere to invest their money with changes that are being proposed, and bearing in mind we don't know that either party are going to win, or any single party, we could have a hung parliament and then who knows what's going to happen. But you've been looking at buy-to-let, for example, and that might be a situation where people think, well, if I'm not getting a good return on a pension, then I'll invest in buy-to-let. And you've been looking at a particular set of figures which show that perhaps buy-to-let's been a bit overblown in people's minds, investment return.
There's this thing that you'll read on any form of investing literature that says past returns are no guide to, you know, the future performance. And buy-to-let, people look at buy-to-let and they think, wow, people have made so much money from this. And they're tempted in. And there were some figures put out this week from a report that showed that buy-to-let investors who'd invested in 1996, which was when buy-to-let actually started, it was a concept that was cooked up by the property industry, would have made a 1,400% return, which massively beat all other assets. So £1,000 put into buy-to-let, theoretically, in 1996 would now be worth £14,900, whereas in shares it was worth £3,000 something. But what you have to remember is two things. Firstly, that return is based on borrowed money. So that's why it has the power to be magnified so much compared to investing in the stock market. You can only invest the money that you actually have in the stock market. You generally can't borrow money to invest. With a property, this is done on a 75% mortgage. So people are only putting in 25% of that money. The other thing to bear in mind is that also they use some formula where you reinvested your rental returns from it and you'd actually bought another property in 2012. So it's not just buying one property. But 1996 was a very good time to buy a property. Properties were cheap. If you look at the long-term relationship between house prices and earnings, it was pretty much near the bottom of where it's been in the last 20 years. The average house in 1996 cost £55,000, which was the same amount that it would have cost you 5 years earlier. So they had bobbed up and down, but they hadn't gone anywhere. And it's actually about £7,000 or 12% cheaper than it would have been at the peak of the 1980s boom. So basically, property had gone nowhere. The reason why 1996 was a good time to buy into property was because if you'd given someone £1,000 in 1996, they probably wouldn't have put it in property. It was an unloved, undervalued asset. Buy that with the benefit of the sort of turbocharging effect of borrowed money, and you end up with these massive returns. The picture looks very different nowadays. Houses are expensive. They're near the top of the range versus earnings. And, you know, house prices are up 234% since 1996. So it looks very different now.
But it's not to say that buy-to-let is a bad investment.
No, I'm not saying it's a bad investment. I'm saying
just not quite as great as...
I said don't expect those interstellar gains to be repeated. I can't see where the money would come from to fund the same property boom that we saw from 1996 to 2007. The whole cheap mortgage, credit, reckless lending kind of boom. I can't see that happening over the next, you know, near 20 years. People investing in buy-to-let should be investing for the rental income. They should do their sums right and just be careful.
So if buy-to-let isn't going to give perhaps the returns that people expect, if politicians are being attacked for raiding pensions, for particularly the wealthier, and it changes the pension system, where will people be looking to invest their money, Tanya?
I think that people mostly go for the stock market. It's going to be for the pension people who are taking advantage of pension freedoms. I think that income drawdown is going to become immensely more popular because people aren't going to buy annuities when they're such poor value. The trouble with that is you do have to really do your homework if you're going to invest, even if you've got a plan that's drawn up for you by a financial advisor that you've paid. You've got to think about how it's going to work for the rest of your life when you might be older and not able to constantly be looking at your investments and seeing if they're still viable. You'll be having to rebalance your portfolio once a year. If you carry on paying a financial advisor, that will be very expensive.
Well, we'll be sticking with this in a short while. 330,000 people called their insurers for more information about the freedoms since they came into force on Easter Monday. But can they cope under the weight?
Morning Money. The markets, the papers and the city. Today's Need to Know on Share Radio.
Every morning from 6 to 9, tune in to Morning Money on Share Radio.
With Sandra Kilhoff and Mark Johnson.
An in-depth look at the UK and global markets and business.
Giving you all the day's need to know.
Morning Money.
Getting you ready for the day ahead.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Well, I promised we'd stick with pensions, and yes, almost 330,000 people have called their insurers for more information about pension freedoms since the reforms came into force on Easter Monday, according to the Association of British Insurers, with pension firms saying they took nearly 230,000 of those within the first 4 days. That's a 214% increase on average call volumes. More than 10,000 written and email requests were also received each day. So, Tanya, you've been looking into this as the pensions expert at This Is Money. Remind us the pension freedoms, very briefly, if you would.
It means that when you're over 55, you can take all of your pension savings at once. You can spend it, save it, invest it as you like. You don't have to buy an annuity with it. You can buy an income drawdown plan of the kind I was just describing, or you can invest in buy-to-let, as Simon was just talking about.
So with so much more responsibility put on the individual, I suppose, are you surprised by the volume of calls?
Not in the slightest. And I was speaking to someone in the pensions industry this week, and she said the first question a lot of people are asking is, how much have I got? It's as basic as that. I think a lot of people are ringing up asking the fundamental questions and asking about the mechanics of how pension freedom is going to work. I don't think they're necessarily ringing up and saying, I want all my money now. I think that very few people are doing that, and they'll have done a lot of homework beforehand if they are. I think people are just ringing up to find out where they stand.
To be clear, is this separate from the number of people calling the government's backed PensionWise service? This is different. This is independent.
I haven't had any figures from PensionWise about the volume of calls they've been getting yet, but I would assume that they're seeing high volumes too.
So people asking how much money they've got. What other sort of questions are they wanting to know the answers to?
Well, I think they want to know about the tax, or if they don't know already about the tax, the pension companies are telling them about the tax. We're getting some evidence back that when people are told about the possibility of having to pay more tax if they take large sums from their pension, that they are actually changing their mind almost on the spot.
Simon, your views on this? Are you surprised by the volume of calls?
Not really, because I've watched the amount of traffic and readers we've seen reading the stories about pension freedom. It's completely dominated the sort of financial landscape, the personal financial landscape over the last year, really. People really are reading these stories a lot. And I think what's really good is this bit where the pension providers are warning people about the tax, because that's been a big concern, that people would basically lose money because they take too much out in one go. What happens is the money that you take out is added to your income for that year, and that you then pay income tax at that level. So say your income potentially was maybe £35,000 in a tax year, and then you retire in that tax year, take some money out that isn't a tax-free lump sum, that's going to be added to the income you had that year, and you could lose thousands of pounds in tax, tens of thousands of pounds in tax. So these people thinking that they can take all the money out to buy their buy-to-let or splash out on the Lamborghini that they should have bought 5 years ago before it went up in value, would suddenly find that they're paying a huge amount of tax to HMRC, and they're not going to be able to get that back. They're not going to be able to say, oh, I didn't mean to take that money out. I never knew I was going to pay that tax. Can I put the money back in and you give me the tax back? That won't happen. Mm-hmm. So these people do need to be warned about that, and so that's something we've been trying to do, certainly. I mean, Tanya's done an excellent job in warning people and laying out this kind of thing for people. You need to think about that. So I'm not surprised about the volume of calls. It sounds like things are going well. I imagine in about 3 months' time, we'll be bombarded with stories from people and telling us their pension freedom nightmares, though.
I don't doubt. But you mentioned Lamborghinis there, and I don't think Pension Minister Steve Webb is ever going to live that one down. But he did say to take your time making your pension choices, as it is a big decision.
we can't absolutely protect people 100%. It is people's own money and we are giving them freedom to choose what to do with it. But we are encouraging people to take up the guidance and making sure by law that the providers flag that guidance, recommend people take it up, and that people do that before they make any choices. Actually, there's probably a good case for taking your time, seeing what products people come up with, thinking it through, looking at the options. So there is no need, no urgency to do things on the 6th. The people who want to do it at the start of the year, we will have made sure that the guidance is in place. But actually, the best thing people can do is take their time because it is a very big decision.
Sound advice, Tanya?
Yes, definitely. You don't have to rush. Obviously, there's quite a lot of pent-up demand because we've been waiting for this to happen for a year. And so some people have delayed their decisions. And if they've spent the last year doing their homework and want to act straight away, that's fine. But for everyone else, I definitely think they should think long and hard about the implications and certainly go to PensionWise. Obviously, for some people, it would be much better to go to an advisor and pay for advice afterwards. But it's a good starting point, I would say.
In your article on This Is Money website, you recommend three important points to consider when deciding whether to take your money out of a pension. What are they?
That was actually advice from the Association of British Insurers, which I repeated.
What do you mean? It's not your own?
The ABI have offered these three points of advice. And they've obviously come up with this based on the kind of questions that people are asking and the kind of areas where they think people might go wrong. The first thing they're saying is go to PensionWise. The second thing they're saying is be very aware of the tax implications, just as Simon was describing. And the third thing is you've got to look at your individual pension terms and conditions. If you've got a guarantee in that, which might benefit you in terms of buying an annuity at a much better rate than you can get on the open market now, then you need to maybe reconsider your plans to take all your money and put it in buy-to-let or go into an income drawdown plan that invests in the stock market, because you might be getting a better deal by still going for an annuity.
Now, Rob Yule of the ABI says that unsurprisingly, many customers recognising the importance of the reforms are contacting their pension provider to understand how the changes may affect them. Insurers have taken steps to meet this demand and will continue to explain to customers their options and encourage them to speak to free, impartial PensionWise service before taking any action. If you do want to call PensionWise, the number is 0300 330 1001.
It actually, if you do want to know about this, we have a special channel on This Is Money, Pensions Freedom Channel. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/pensionsfreedom, and there you will find a full set of guides to all the things that you need to know about.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
One final point on pensions, though, I should say. Simon, you've been answering readers' questions we mentioned a little bit earlier there about pensions with the help of Alan Higham, who's the Retirement Director at Fidelity Worldwide Investments. What questions have you particularly been answering?
We've just looked at some of the typical questions that readers are asking. I mean, one of them involved someone who got in contact with us and said they had a £100,000 pension pot. And they wanted to keep it invested. They didn't want to buy an annuity, but they were too tight to pay for financial advice. So what should they do and how should they invest it? So there's been a lot of questions around how should they invest. And then this other one this week was from someone who asked, should I take a tax-free lump sum from my pension? They said they had a final salary pension of £10,000 a year, but then they also had a private pension pot of about £50,000. And was it worth taking the tax-free lump sum? I mean, Alan's response was that what they need to think about is they've got that £10,000 income from final salary pension. They've got the state pension, which is about £6,000 or £7,000 a year. If you add those two together, say it's £17,000, is that enough secure income for you to live on? Are you happy with that? If you are, then you can think about using that private pension pot and taking that tax-free lump sum, which, because it's tax-free, is generally a good thing. Put it into an ISA or something, and then with the rest of it, consider either going into drawdown where you keep your pension invested and you then take money from it as you need it, or buying an annuity which will add to that secure income. And this is exactly the kind of example where it really pays off for people to get financial advice. And people balk a bit at the idea of paying for financial advice. And there was a survey last week that said basically half of people would be willing to take it with their pension and they thought they should pay about £500. In actual fact, it would cost them about £1,500. But it's actually well worth paying that money because it could get you an extra £1,500 worth of income every year for the rest of your life. Speculate to accumulate.
That voice you're hearing, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Tanya Jeffries, both in the studio with me from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Coming up, how divorce could slash your retirement income by over £2,000 a year.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Now, divorcees suffer a £2,100 a year hit to their pension income. That's according to the Prudential Research, which has revealed how breakups can take a toll on finances into old age. So people planning to retire this year who've gone through at least one divorce expect to get an annual retirement income of £15,700, while those who've never divorced anticipate receiving £17,800 a year. So, Tanya, you've been looking into this. Why does divorce affect your individual pension pots so much?
It's all the costs of divorce, the legal fees, and also setting up a new home. That comes to quite a lot of unavoidable expenses. You're also not able to step up your contributions or maybe make so many contributions while all that is ongoing, and then you can only pick it up again maybe afterwards. The other side of it is that official statistics say that people are most likely to get divorced when they're between 40 and 44, mm-hmm. and that is often when people are earning the most. So this money is diverted elsewhere into the cost of divorce at the very point where you might be making the maximum contributions and really stepping up saving for retirement.
Also, it's affecting the level of debt. Divorcees retire with a higher rate of debt.
Yes, it wasn't a great deal more, but it certainly was more. And as I was saying, there's certain amounts of expenses with divorce that you can't get out of. Therefore, I can see why people would go into debt. They can't get out of paying legal fees often with divorce, so it has to be paid somehow.
You say here that divorce could also be pushing more retirees into poverty, as 19% of those who've split from a partner end up on an income below £9,500. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation minimum income standard for a single pensioner. Did you look at those who'd never got married? Singletons.
I don't think it did, but there is a comment here from one of our readers who said, "Also in this category, I've had to struggle at times, but without the drag of a partner's gross expenses and a brighter outlook on life, I made it with no debts." So there is, I think underlying the suggestion there is that basically you don't suffer other people spending the money and mm-hmm. you can be more prudent yourself if you're a singleton. Look, there is actually, and this is an issue across life. It doesn't matter whether you're retiring or younger. There is an economy of scale of being in a partnership. You know, at the most basic level, it's much cheaper to rent somewhere to live, because if you can have one bedroom and two of you paying for it, rather than if you want to be a proper adult and have your own bedroom, then you've got to pay for the whole flat yourself. You can't just share the bedroom with a mate. The other thing is buying a house. You know, one of the hardest things for first-time buyers is saving up the huge deposit they need. The average house mm-hmm. costs about £180,000. 20% deposit on that is £36,000. It's much easier to raise that £36,000 if there's two of you than if there's one of you. And then on top of that, it's easier to pay that mortgage. Again, like the rent, you can split it. So there is, you know, this economy of scale that goes throughout life that follows you all the way from, you know, your early 20s right up to retirement, where essentially two people living together don't have the same costs as, you know, one person plus one person.
Tanya, how can people protect themselves as much as you can?
Well, it's very difficult, because if you decide to get divorced and that is what you're going to do, then these expenses have to be paid somehow, and that's probably how people start running up debts. If your affairs are complicated, I think it is worth thinking about getting financial advice, because as we were talking about earlier with people who are embarking on retirement, it could actually save you a lot of money in the long run. And maybe once you've sorted out the legal fees, it's worth getting your finances in order with a financial advisor at that point. And then you're doing it at that point, as opposed to waiting until you're 65 or so and then having to start all over again.
And it's also worth bearing in mind that actually it can have a real emotional toll on you, a very stressful time, and you might need sort of someone who's a bit more detached from the situation to help guide you. Welcome if you've just joined us. I'm Georgie Frost, here every weekday from 9 until 1 on Digital Online and through the Share Radio mobile app. That voice you're hearing there, journalist Tanya Jeffries, also with us in the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money. Now, a fall in the number of properties coming onto the market will keep prices rising in the coming year, and experts are warning we could be facing a very real housing crisis. The Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors is predicting a 2.5% increase in the next 12 months, and that'll go up by a further 4.5% each year for the next 5 years. Most areas of the UK saw a drop in the number of available homes during March. Biggest decline, though, well, that was in England, where people seem to be waiting to move until after the general election. With housing very much on the political agenda, it feels like a pretty uncertain time for the market. Simon, would that be a fair reflection? And firstly, why the rises and the falls in the number of properties coming onto the market?
Actually, I think this is quite an interesting dynamic about the property market at the moment. The property market is theoretically riding quite high. We saw quite strong house price gains last year. London just raging ahead, although that suddenly sort of came to a halt round about last autumn, and it cooled down a lot. But anybody who's actually looking for a property to buy in London will tell you that it's still insanely difficult, as Rachel, one of our journalists, is, you know, really struggling with all of this. But there is this thing where there's not a lot of properties up for sale. So I've noticed this when looking around. I keep an eye on the property market, like local to me and local to where my mum lives and things like that, just, you know, sort of looking at these things. And there does seem to be a shortage of properties for sale. So whilst the market's cooled down slightly in some of those like southeast and London areas, there's also less properties for sale. And I don't know why people aren't putting their properties up for sale. I mean, one thing I would say is that it's very expensive to move. We saw a stamp duty cut this year where it's actually taken a decent chunk out of the cost of moving, but it is still very expensive for people to move. Stamp duty is still quite a lot of money. Add that to estate agents' fees, add that to all the legal costs and everything like that, and people, for some reason, very reluctant to move, which is surprising because actually house prices are going up a bit and mortgage rates are very low.
Is it just that people are not wanting to move, or is it also the fact that there is a housing shortage?
We don't build enough homes, that's true. But it depends on what you judge to be enough homes, and there's some questions over the numbers. But actually, if you look at the figures of homes that are being built, private developers, house builders, is down quite a bit. But you would expect that. We just had the biggest financial crisis the world has ever seen, which was driven by a load of clowns in the property market. And all of those house builders nearly went bust. So they're being a bit more cautious. You would expect them to be being cautious at this point in the cycle. But, you know, their building has picked up. But actually, where the number of homes has dropped is council homes, local authority homes. We don't make any of those anymore. We make a few housing association homes, but not enough to fill the gap. So actually, that's really where the shortage is.
Well, it's been claimed mortgage lending decreased as buyers are getting nervous ahead of next month's general election. So could it be the election affecting this?
Well, it probably is, because people are affected by that kind of thing. I would say, though, that if you're ready to buy or sell, you should just get on with it. It's going to take you 3, maybe 4 months anyway. So I really don't think whatever the outcome is, it's going to affect the property market so much that you should be holding off.
Well, earlier I spoke to independent mortgage broker Simon Tyler about what he'd like to see from the elections when it comes to housing, and he agrees we've got a housing crisis on our hands.
The biggest problem we've got is the amount of housing stock. And it'd be nice to see something akin to a royal commission where all the parties agreed a 20-year position on housing and how they should build it, because it's not going to resolve itself. And one party criticising each other isn't going to get more houses built, and people are still arriving in the UK, in the South East, seeking jobs, mainly in the South East, where there are less houses. Supply and demand means these house prices continue to rise. Forgetting the not-in-my-backyard issue, clearly, we need to build on more brownfield sites. We need more high-rise in the centre of London. We need more properties in the green belt around London. We need more properties built along the HS2 line if it comes into being. And that's a 20-year cycle. Not good news if you've got lovely views and you're not going to lose them. But ultimately, for the economy and for society in general, to have housing that's more affordable and more of it is better. It's all very well for those of us who live in reasonably valued houses who've ridden the wave, but for the young people coming in at the bottom, it doesn't look so good.
Well, your reaction to that?
The one thing I would say is the big problem with housing in this country is that it's too expensive. House prices are too high. Some of that will be down to not building enough homes, but the most of that is down to cheap credit and a property boom that ran from 1997 through to 2007. And when that bubble burst, we made the decision to bring interest rates down to 0.5% and do everything we possibly could to stop those house prices falling. Had we allowed the market to correct and those house prices to fall, they would not be as expensive as they are now. Ireland and the States and Spain all had big property bubbles and big house price gains, just like we did. But the difference between us and them is they built a lot of houses while they were doing it. So there was no shortage of homes there, yet they still had house prices go to insane levels. The difference is the house prices there were allowed essentially to correct and to crash, and now property in Spain and Ireland and America is not expensive, but property in the UK is. And you don't necessarily solve all of that problem just by building a lot more homes.
Well, we've heard a lot in the manifestos that have been released this week about housing by the political parties. Is there anything in them that you think will help to solve this?
I don't think anything can solve it straight away. I do think we need to build more homes, and the right to buy policy doesn't really address that. It's just going to ramp up demand even more, potentially.
When you talk about the right to buy extension, what are we talking about here?
Well, right to buy enables people since Margaret Thatcher's time to buy their council homes at a discount to the market value. And it's now going to be extended to housing association tenants as well.
It's a Conservative proposal.
Yeah, it's a Conservative proposal. And the shift in the way sort of the housing market works has seen a lot of what would have in the past been local authority council tenants are now housing association tenants. And the concern is that it's all very well selling the tenants these homes, and there's arguments as to why home ownership helps people and all these other things, but you need to replace them. And without a policy that says we're definitely going to replace them and we guarantee we're going to replace them, we're just going to run down the stock of affordable homes. Because realistically, it's not the house builders, the private developers that are the problem. It is the what would have been council houses, what would have been local authority homes, what are now housing association houses that are the problem. And so I don't think it really solves the problem at all. As Tanya said, basically you're just increasing demand and not increasing supply.
Tanya?
One of the bits of good news I saw this week was that Sainsbury's is now looking at its unused sites and planning to build homes on it. It's starting in quite a small way, but this is a step in the right direction. We've written a lot about the troubles that the big supermarket retailers are having. They've obviously got too many stores. If they are going into partnership with house builders and building more homes on these brownfield sites, which are often in the centre of towns where people want to live anyway, then that's got to be a step in the right direction. I hope we'll see more of that.
You say brownfields there. Someone suggested greenfields. Is it worth doing that, the green belt?
It is, probably. I grew up outside of a town in the Greenbelt, okay, and so I do not agree with some of the ideas about building on the Greenbelt, because this whole NIMBYism, not in my backyard, it's like, well, if you don't protect your backyard, who's going to? Actually, I think that's just taking responsibility for your local area, which is sometimes promoted as a good policy. But what I think is really important about building more homes, and I think this is where the problem lies, is if we're going to build more homes, if we're going to build more council homes, if we're going to build more housing association homes, if we're going to build more private homes, we need to win the public over and convince them that that's a good idea and that all those other things that should come with homes will be delivered. Schools, hospitals, roads, railways that work and you don't get ripped off on. And people have watched for decades as none of that stuff has been done properly. And so, understandably, they are anti more homes being built where they live, where there aren't enough school places. They've got to drive 40 minutes to the hospital because all the local hospitals have been closed, and they can't get on a train in the morning despite paying 20 quid to go to work. So it's hardly surprising that people turn around and go, no, not in my backyard, thank you very much. So what I would say to the house builders and the property industry and the government and anybody else who wants to go building lots of homes is go out and win those people over. Convince them you're going to do the right thing and you're not just going to make the same mess that we've been making for decades.
When we talk about a housing crisis, What exactly are we talking about here? How bad could this be? Who's going to be particularly affected? I mean, we throw around terms like a housing crisis. What do we actually mean by that?
I think what the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors were referring to here is the fact that
they're not alone.
There's a lot of hey, it's really good that people are having the debate about this. This is a really important issue. The property market is interlinked so much with how our economy does. We're so reliant on it. We need to take a step back from that. And it would have been a really good time to do so after the financial crisis. Unfortunately, a lot of the measures that we've taken to try and get the economy back on its feet involve stimulating the housing market and driving prices up even further. We need to get away from this association of high house prices as being a good thing, because ultimately they are a good thing if you happen to be in a lucky generation who's lived in a house that's worth, you know, many, many, many more hundreds of thousands of pounds than you paid for it. But then also you might have kids who now can't afford to live in their local area. You also can only really cash that in two scenarios. One, you either move to somewhere in the country that's much cheaper, which then creates a problem for that other part of the country, and also might not be where you want to live, so that's not really a win. Or you could sell up, but then you've got to live somewhere, so you'll have to rent somewhere locally. That's probably not going to be any cheaper. Or you die, and the money gets handed to your children. And dying is not normally considered a good scenario for most people, so that's not a win either. So it's high house prices really only benefit the government, because it gets to take more tax, the bank, because it gets to lend you more money, and people who own multiple investment properties, which are a minority of people. For the vast majority of people in this country, high house prices are not a good thing.
You've gone a little bit pink of face there, Simon.
I think this is really important. But you try telling this to people and they're like, no, my house is going up in value. That's a good thing.
Well, there you go. You're on the soapbox now. Before we step off and talk about tax disc, a lot of people getting caught out paying hefty fines or having their cars clamped. We'll tell you all about this in a short while. But I will mention that if you are thinking of moving home, new research out by the Post Office Money and the Centre for Economics and Business Research says that people are underestimating quite a lot the cost of moving home. Prospective buyers can now pay almost £12,000 on average, nearly double what it says they expect to. So estate agency fees alone increasing by 61% over the last decade. Additional costs involved in moving are estimated to reach more than 15,000 by 2020. Go on, Simon. You've got to a more normal colour now, but can we get you to maybe purple?
Well, what makes it even more expensive is because house prices are so high. So look, right, OK, if your house goes up by 10% in value and all other houses go up by 10% in value, most people, when they move, buy a bigger house. So the bigger house will have gone up by 10% in value. That is a larger amount of money than your house has gone up in value by. So the gap between your house and that other house has got bigger. So you've got to find all that money, and then you've also got to find all this money for moving costs. But you can cut those. You don't have to pay estate agents so much money for a start.
How do you do that? How can you cut some of these fees? Let's be a bit positive. Come on, Simon.
You could use one of the new breed of online estate agents who charge you a flat rate. You could shop around for your removal company. You could move stuff yourself. Enlist some friends. Buy them lunch. You probably need to use a solicitor. You can't do that yourself, unfortunately. If you could, I bet a lot of people would.
I think you've given us enough. There's
all kinds of ways you can, you know, cut the cost of moving.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Very warm welcome. If you've just joined us, I'm Georgie Frost here on Consumer Issues on Share Radio every weekday from 9 until 1 on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. In the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Tanya Jeffries from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Simon has got to a much more normal colour. So let's look at probably one of the most popular stories on your website right now, I believe, in thousands of drivers having their cars towed away and facing fines as much as £800 for falling foul of car tax rule changes that were introduced by the DVLA. Now, while most motorists know that tax discs are no longer required, what many don't realise is that following the changes, if a car is sold, well, the tax is automatically cancelled if a car changes ownership, even if there's a valid disc in the window. Remind us, Tanya, if you would, about what's changed with tax disc rules.
The main difference is if you're buying a car, you don't take on the car tax period of the seller as you used to be able to do. You actually have to buy your own car tax from the point that you actually buy it.
So even if it's got like 6 months to run, you still have to buy a whole nother year?
Yes, you have to. It, and the seller gets a refund on anything that was over.
Ah, I see. Well, that's not too bad then, I suppose. Why did they bring these changes in?
Modern age, move of the times, sending out a tax disc seemed a bit archaic when you could do it all over the internet. And also because there's a massive con going on here. See, you thought you'd calm me down, didn't you? So Tanya asked me this question. She's like, but what was the logic behind this change yesterday? Yes. Like, why can't you continue this, keeping the tax thing? Was there a reason moving it, you know, you could get rid of the tax disc, but you could still sell the tax with the car? And yeah, you could. The tax is attached to the car. It's not attached to you. But what happens is, when the previous owner cashes in their remaining tax, they get the full remaining months on it. So if you sell your car in the first half of the month, you don't get the rest of the month as well, and then all the other months. You just get all the other whole months. And when you buy a car, you should theoretically, you have to pay for that month that you've bought it in as well. So if you buy a car on the 28th of the month, then rather than just being able to wait until the start of the next month, so say you bought a car on the 28th of April, right?
Yeah.
Rather than just being able to say, right, well, I'll tax it from May, you actually have to tax it from the start of April. So you're paying for the whole of April as well, even though the previous owner has also paid for the whole of April and isn't getting their money back. Now, I want to do a Freedom of Information Act request on this and try and find it out, because it's only a small amount of money, but it's a lot of people, and that adds up. And the government is coining it in on this trick.
And also, one, they're coining it in on that, but people are getting caught out. They're getting the cars taken away and having to pay a lot of money.
The fees are absolutely shocking. I went down the list in the story that we did about it, and it's fees for everything, and they mount up really quickly. They mount up by the day. So if you're unlucky to get caught out on this, then you could be looking at a substantial bill. And these people are not really criminals. They're people who have not understood the new car tax rules. Why should people's finances be completely knocked sideways? 800 quid is an awful lot of money for some people. It could really sort of destroy your finances if you're not very well off to start with. In our story, we covered a couple who had just swapped the ownership of the car between them. They just changed the names, and they fell foul of it as a result, because they should have taken out new car tax for themselves as a result of this. They were unlucky enough to be on holiday when they were discovered. And so presumably their fees mounted up a great deal just because it took them longer to sort it out. The fees just didn't seem to make any sense when I looked at it.
What else have your readers been saying to you about this? Has it got them as incensed as you?
Well, Dave27 in Birmingham says, absolute disgrace. James Buckingham says, but they don't give you a refund for any full remaining month's tax, which is what I just said. I had 9 full months left and I got 8 back. They told me because they received the logbook after the end of the month, that counted against me. And actually, there's a point here about some of these cars, which is many years back, this happened. I know someone who this happened to, is they got their car, it was parked in London on the street, and they didn't use it all the time, and it wasn't actually parked on their street. And they managed to get it impounded because it was parked in the wrong place. And by the time they went to get the car back from the pound, it was only like a week or something, but all those fees that we were talking about had mounted up, and the pound wanted something like £1,000, and the car wasn't worth it. So they just like said, right, fine, and left it to be crushed. And that's going to be happening around the country to people. There's going to be a reasonable number of people who are just going, well, my car's not worth 800 quid, crush it. That's very wasteful. That's not green, is it? Crushing perfectly good cars.
It's not green. Well, we will stick with the theme of cars, not the environment, but reliability. So Bentleys, Porsches, they may be posh, and they may be on most of our wish lists. But according to a new survey from What Car magazine, they're prone to break down more than other cars. What came out top as the most reliable? Well, it was Honda, followed by Suzuki and Toyota. So Japanese and South Korean manufacturers once again dominating the list. What Car looked at things like car failure rate, age, mileage, and importantly, the cost of repair. So, Simon, Tanya, why did Honda come out on top?
because they're more reliable than the other cars. No, it's Honda's Japanese cars.
When you say more reliable,
they don't break down as much.
And when they do?
And when they do, they get fixed easier.
And cheaper.
And cheaper. Look, I mean, the thing is Japanese and cars and, you know, have always had a reputation for reliability and quality. And that was actually what Honda, you know, built their success upon. They came, you know, they launched all these small cars, you know, in the sort of that era of the 70s when people were making cars really, really badly in many places, especially in Britain, and said, hey, look, we've built this car and it works and it won't break down. And unsurprisingly, people like that in their cars. And you find some glamour names propping up the bottom of this.
Yeah, so at the bottom, what happened to Vorsprung Dirk Technik?
Well, so here's a surprise, right? Mm. Okay. BMW, which everybody thinks of as a very reliable manufacturer, only comes in 28th in this list. Below that, you've then got Jaguar, then you've got Mercedes-Benz, and then propping up the pile, you've got Audi, Jeep, Porsche and Bentley. Made and designed in Britain. And they're very good cars. They just happen to not
come
be
out.
Quite as reliable as a Honda, and when they do break down, it costs you a lot more money to fix. But you know what? If you put a Honda and a Bentley on the street outside and you said, which would you like? I take the Bentley, even with its footballer connotations.
OK, but bear in mind you have to pay for it. Therefore, how important is reliability when it comes to purchasing our purchasing choices of cars? Does it make a big impact? Or if you've got a big wad of cash, you're going to go for the Bentley anyway, like you said.
That's a really good point, right? It matters a lot more if you are the mass market car buyer than if you're the person buying a Bentley. If you're the person buying a Bentley, you've got quite a lot of money and you want a Bentley and it's a status symbol and it's a really nice, very fast, very luxurious car. But if you're someone who's looking for a 15 to 20 grand car, then the reliability is probably going to be very important to you and you don't have the money to splash on unnecessary repairs. So yeah, reliability matters. And you see car makers, you know, they make a big thing about reliability and they really want to be at the top of this list, not at the bottom. And I'm sure Bentley and Porsche won't be happy about this.
I'm also wondering as well, if you go into a garage and you're driving a Bentley, are they not going to go, oh, well, that could be a little bit more expensive than normal because they think you've got more money?
No, they'll have a Nespresso machine and a sofa and glossy brochures and things like that.
What, they don't go to a normal mechanic?
No, it's not. You just don't go down to Terry's place and say, oh, Terry, my car's knackered.
What cars do you both drive and how reliable would you suggest they are?
I can't really answer this because I don't own a car. I live in London, so I use public transport and then I hire a car or get a taxi when I actually need one.
Well, I'll answer for both of us then because I live in London and I've got two cars.
Oh, Simon!
I've got a family as well. Our family car is a Jaguar X-Type Estate, which sounds a bit posh and fancy, but actually they're really good cars and a lot cheaper than the equivalent BMW or Audi. Whilst they deliver the same kind of performance and comfort and everything like that. I've got a classic car, a 1980s classic car as well. I've got a Peugeot 205 GTI.
Oh, Peugeots do better. Number 12, but Jaguar, number 30.
Mine's 24 years old, though, so...
My Peugeot was brilliantly reliable until the exhaust fell off on the M1.
My Peugeot has been reliable, and it's also a classic car and goes very fast.
All right, Simon, all right.
That was Peugeot top trumps.
There we go, exactly. That was editor Simon Lambert, journalist Tanya Jeffries from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Thank you so much for joining us.